Thank you very much. The truth of the matter is that somebody asked me once, what would you like them to say at your funeral? I said, look, he's alive! Anyway, this is the subject of inappropriate funeral comment. That's why God made me a Kohen. And I don't go to these things. It is such a pleasure and a privilege to be back here in Dunwoody. And I have to tell you, as I was putting together this particular tour, I sent out an email of all the places where I have been last year, assuming that, of course, mostly, for the most part, the places I was at in November were taken back in November, the places in March, May. And I was just in Dunwoody in May. I was very surprised when the rabbi said, you know, yes, we would like you very much to come back. And I was sort of surprised. I was just there in May. I said, this is right, but you left this cliffhanger. You know what I mean? You stopped in the middle and you said, oh, you'll have to bring me back for the second speech. And a lot of people are waiting to hear the second part to it, you know? Unfortunately, there really isn't a second part. I was just kidding. Anyway, it's just a technique we speak of. But the truth of the matter is that it is. And I will review where we are now. This is the new method, of course. It used to be people just got up and taught a shiur. Now we always use a cliffhanger. This was developed by the same rabbis who wrote Prison Break. And they set it up along the similar lines, and you know, you never really know what's happening next. So Baruch Hashem. So just the story so far. Okay, where we left our heroes, right? We were talking about the... Thank you. Do you want the Rosh Hashiva look? I'll give you that too. Anyway... should be a Jew, and we were talking about how there are so few people who really have a good and cogent answer to that question. Why should a person be a Jew? And we said last time what is so incredibly important, and that is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us in this world not to serve Him. He is infinite. He's fine. We're not here to do mitzvos, to rack up brownie points. We are not here to avoid burning in hell. We're not here for any of those things. We are here to get this unbelievable spiritual pleasure that comes from being in this world. Which then, of course, leads to the second question. Okay, I'm with you. I'm game. I am prepared to get this unbelievable spiritual pleasure. Hit me with the pleasure race. Well, and I'm ready. If that's what I'm here for, just take me away, Calgon. You know what I mean? I'm ready. Just give me all this pleasure. Make me feel good. Why do I have to do anything? And it's interesting how often when I'll be speaking to a university audience and they'll say to me, Rabbi, I don't mind being an observant Jew. It's just I don't want to keep all these laws. And I appreciate where they're coming from. You know what I mean? So why do we have to keep all these laws for? Mitzvah, 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 mitzvah. And it's absolutely amazing. You know? We throw around these numbers, right? 613 commandments, right? Okay, so a lot of them don't really apply, and, you know, a lot of them, you know, are only special life events, and they don't apply. Oh, fine, forgetting about that. But still a pretty intimidating number. 613 commandments. And what is this concept of commandments? And I have to point this out. Mitzvahs. When I was growing up, a mitzvah was a good deed. Do a mitzvah, help the old lady across the street. Do a mitzvah, help your mother with the bands, right? It was a good deed. Be a Boy Scout. Mitzvah is from the word tzav, commandment. Thou shalt not. Now, it's interesting. I had three boys from a reform high school in Israel who told me something. I later read it in an article in the Jewish Week by another reform rabbi, and someone told me they saw it on the website. So it's hard to talk about Reformed theology because it's part of the theology. They don't really have a theology and that there's a lot of freedom of choice and thought. But this is from three separate sources. What do they tell these students? We don't look at them as the Ten Commandments. We look at them as the Ten Suggestions. maybe don't kill. Try not to see. See if you can stay away from my wife. Suggestions, ideas for living. You know what I mean? Now this is their position, and I want to do something I don't usually get an opportunity to do where I teach in Jerusalem. I would like to defend the Reform position. Because there is a logic here. It does make sense. You know, I don't want to be flippant. I understand why they say that. I was in eighth grade in the Hebrew Academy of Nassau County. We were learning a Gemara and Kedushin, I remember, where the following question came up. Who gets more reward, whatever that means, for doing a mitzvah? A Jew or a non-Jew? To put it into terms, right, you are a university student, and you have decided, you know, that you're going to keep kosher. And there's a nice Catholic girl who's friendly with you, Mary O'Hara. And Mary O'Hara says, and what's that you're doing? He said, well, I'm keeping kosher. What does that mean? Well, it says in the Bible you can't eat animals that don't have split hoofs and chew its cud, and you can't this, and you have to that, you can do this, you know. And she says, you know, that sounds beautiful. I'm going to do it too. And the two of you keep kosher for the rest of your life. Right? That's a beautiful thing. Now, I'm complicating matters because, you know, some people will say, well, you told her to do it. No, she said, she happened to be reading Leviticus. It happens all the time. She came across these laws on her own. She decided she's going to keep, you know, that, or maybe she stumbled on an Uncle Moshe tape. You know what I mean? All the animals that I eat must chew their cud and have split feet. Kosher food just can't be beat. I eat only kosher. Now, who wouldn't be inspired? Who wouldn't be? Oh, that would make almost anybody. Jew or Gentile. Every time you're in the market, look for the food with the kosher sign on it. It's good for me. It's good for you. And Hashem, He loves it too. And that just says it all to me. I mean, that's the reason to keep kosher. So she decides to keep kosher at home. And at the end of your life, the two of you get upstairs, and you kept kosher, and she kept kosher. Who gets more reward? This was the question that was posed to us, eighth grade budding scholars. And most of us said, without hesitation, of course the non-Jew gets more reward. Because there's a general concept called extra credit. I don't have to do it. It was nice of me to do it. I wasn't required to do it. I went above and beyond. Of course I should get extra. It's obvious. Says the Gemara, no, the Jew gets more reward. Why? Because he is commanded. And if he is commanded, then it's worth more. Why? Because there's a simple psychological reality. Once you tell somebody you have to, you don't want to. Right? Everyone knows this. Those of you who are teenagers or college students, those of you who have teenagers or college students, you understand this quite well. Right? You wake up one morning and your room is a wreck, even by your very low standards. You say, I'm going to clean up my room today. All pizza boxes more than 3 months, I'm throwing out. You know, any clothing that stands on its own goes into the wash. You know, bring a lawnmower, see what I can do with the carpet. You know what I mean? And you really determine. Now, if you've ever gone through this, you lying in bed, psyching yourself up for the task ahead, and suddenly your mother opens the room and says, this place is a pigsty. Clean it up. Now I don't want to. But you wanted to a minute ago. That's before you told me I have to. And once you tell me I have to, I don't want it. And if you want to see this in its clearest, strongest form, it's called a fasting. There are people who never eat breakfast, ever. They don't have a cup of coffee, they don't have a Danish, not a Pop-Tart, not an English muffin, nothing. Nothing. If mothers have cried bitter tears, if the mothers are born, they have something to eat, I'm not hungry. They don't eat breakfast. There are some people who don't eat breakfast and they can miss lunch. I've heard there are people like this. I heard a report on the radio, which, Baruch Hashem, that millions of dollars of your money is being spent on important research, and they found out that people who are not overweight don't think about food as much as those of us who are. Baruch Hashem, we did a study on that. But you have these people who are like, you know, I don't know, I really should eat something, but I'm so busy. I don't know, I've never had that problem. said to my wife, I didn't eat anything today. She said, what do you mean? You had eggs for breakfast, and you had a big salad for lunch. Oh. But besides that, I forget what I did eat. But there are people who just don't eat. They never eat breakfast. Sometimes they miss lunch about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They suddenly realize that they're hungry and they eat something, right? And these people never feel like they have to eat breakfast ever until it's a fast day. And then 9 o'clock in the morning, they're pacing up and down. I'm never going to make it. I think I better lie down. I think I have a headache. Oh, my gosh. How am I going to get like this? What time is it? 9:01. Oh, what is it? Oh my gosh, this is so terrible. So what's the problem? I didn't eat anything today. You never eat anything. You have never eaten breakfast your whole life. But I always could. And once you tell me I can't, I'm starving. And this is just reality. Once you tell somebody they can't, then they want to. Therefore, comes along the reform and says, well, if I tell you that they're commandments, you have a psychological block, and you're not going to want to do it. So I'm going to call it suggestions, and then I'm going to free you from that psychological block and make it easier for you. Makes great sense. Makes great sense. And yet, we old stuck-in-the-wall Jews, we still call them commandments, we still call them mitzvos. And the truth is that if you do, there is this mental block of I have to that we now have to get over. Why is it there? I was talking to a group of students who were visiting Israel from Los Angeles. A few of them were actors, a few were directors, the head cheerleaders of the Lakers. She was Jewish. It was a typical cross-section of American youth of the Jewish persuasion that you'd expect to find anywhere. And I was giving this class. And I remember when I came to this particular question, I said, why would, you know, God make them commandments knowing that then we don't want to do it? So one of these students raised their hand and said, because then if you do it, it's worth more. I said, you mean you thought Judaism was too easy? So we have to create a little mental block. The 613 commandments, that's a cinch. I got to make it harder for you. He goes, well, if it's harder, then it's worth more. I said, you know what? I'm not going to argue the point with you, but let's phrase it. Do you really believe it? Or is that what you think the rabbi wants to hear? And they said, that's what the rabbi wants to hear. I said, does that motivate you to want to go out and do mitzvahs? He says, absolutely not. So what I said the last time, and this is so important, the point is not that we learn Judaism to get insights, you know, into 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, any kind of theoretical construct. It has to make sense to me in my life in 2009, or we wouldn't still be around as a people. It's got to be relevant to our lives, which means there has to be a good reason why they're commandments, something that's positive in it. You know, not just like somebody will tell me, well, then people will feel like they don't have to do it. I say, I got news for you. People feel like they don't have to do it anyway. There are plenty of people not keeping them, even though we call them mitzvahs, even though we say that you have to. There has to be a positive reason that they are commandments and not suggestions. So I want to put it into the following terms. You have a good friend. Let's pretend. And let's assume that you're not married, you're a single person, you have a good friend, and you're driving at night, and you break down in the middle of nowhere, 2 o'clock in the morning. You don't have a cell phone. Your parents are out of town. You start walking, immediately it starts to rain. It's raining, and you're cold, and you walk for a mile till you find the phone, and you call your best friend. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning now, and the phone is ringing and ringing and ringing. And finally, sleepily, your phone friend picks up the phone and says, yeah? And says, hi, it's me. Oh, are you calling me in the middle of the night? You know, I got to get up in the morning. Listen, I'm in the middle of nowhere. My car broke down. It's raining. I'm cold. I have nobody else I can call. Will you please come and pick me up? Oh, so the guy's starting to wake up now. He realizes the seriousness of the situation. You're in the middle of nowhere. It's raining. It's cold. Nope. Hang up the phone. Now, when you see this guy the next day, what's the first thing you're going to... Well, forget the first thing you're going to say. I know the first thing. Let's get past that, you know. And you talk about him and his mother. And after you get past all that, you know, all the essential discussions, what's the next point you're going to make? You're not my friend. What are you talking about? You weren't there for me. What is this kind of Jewish guilt trip? What are you, my grandmother? You know what I mean? Where's it written? I got to come out in the middle of the night. I was tired. It was cold. I don't want to pick you up. That doesn't mean I'm not your friend. We can still go out for a couple of beers. We can go and watch a movie. What's the big deal? Okay. If we decide to keep this relationship, we're going to seriously downgrade it. Because even though we never spelled it out, we never signed a contract, we understand that if you are my friend, I can expect things of you. I can count on you. You're going to be there for me. And if you're not, then you're not a friend. You may be an acquaintance. And therefore, if you think about it, every relationship comes with commandments, not suggestions. Commandments. And the higher the level of relationship, the more I have to's commandments come along with it, right? I grew up in New York in the 70s, out in the suburbs of Long Island. It was known that if you... Oh, there's three of us here. Anyway, and you can ask them why they moved here. Anyway, so... When it was known for any kid growing up in Long Island, if you go into Manhattan, you have a life expectancy of minutes. You're going to get killed, robbed, murdered, cut up into pieces, dropped into the river. Everyone knew this. It was a given, you know? Now, if you were to take a subway because you were really suicidal and you sat down, that's probably the lowest level relationship you can imagine, sitting next to someone on the subway. So this, even that relationship comes with obligations. Don't kill me. You want to rob me? That's acceptable. A guy told me he got robbed in the train. The guy was very nice, you know, went through his pockets, took his money. Thank you very much. It was very, very, very congenial, you know what I mean? You want to spread your legs so I'm falling off the bed? Fine. You want to not have showered for months? Fine. All that. But once you kill me, you've passed a certain level of our relationship, even though it's a very low-level relationship, right? You have a neighbor. Neighbors may not be friends. Sometimes neighbors are friends, sometimes they're not. And nonetheless, that relationship comes with commandments. Don't park in front of my driveway. Don't let your kids run in my flowers. And that's it. You pass each other, hi Bob, hi Bob, Steve. You know, that's it. I don't need more than that. We don't have to be friends. We don't have to get together socially. But it has levels. Friends has levels. As you move up in a relationship, there are more and more obligations. So, well, a young couple gets married and, you know, and the wife meets an old friend of hers from university, you know, and they are so excited to see each other. They do that girl primal scream thing they do when they see some of the other, It's so beautiful. This is the bonding moment. Guys are similar when they meet someone they haven't seen in a while. It's like, hey. Same basic idea. So what's doing, then? Anyway, that is, oh, I'm so excited. I haven't seen you in a while. It's been 3 years. How you doing? What's happening? And the husband is watching this whole scene unfold. Right? Okay. The next day, gets up in the morning, he leaves, comes back 3 years later. The reaction is going to be dramatically different. It might involve a weapon. And the husband says to the wife, wait a second, I'm missing something here. You saw this person from university that you haven't seen in such a long time. You were so excited to see her. You haven't seen her in 3 years. I imagine me, you'd be even happier to see me after 3 years. And she said, you idiot, don't you get the difference? This is a marriage. A marriage is a higher level relationship. It's 24/7. I got news for you. If I never see that girl again, my life will be fine. But I expect you to be here. Because the higher the level of relationship, the more commandments there are, the more expectations there are. One can only imagine if there are no expectations, if nobody cares, is that going to make anybody happier? Guy's working late in the office. He calls up his wife. He says, honey, I'm going to be late. He says, that's okay. No, but I'm not going to make it home for supper. It's all right. No, I didn't want you to wait for me. I wasn't going to. Oh. Well, I don't want you to wait up for me. I wasn't going to. Oh. Well, I might work right through the night. I mean, I should be there in the morning. Listen, come home. Don't come home. Whatever you want to do. The last thing I want to do is be a burden to you. If you come home, I'm happy to see you. If you don't come home, that's also fine. Few and far between are the guys who are going to hang up the phone and say, what a great and understanding wife I have. They're going to say, she doesn't love me. She's another man. What's going on here? Why doesn't she expect me to be there? Why doesn't it make a difference? People want to be needed. I talk to young people who are looking to get married, and I ask them, do you have your list? And they always deny it, but they always have one. They have a list, what I'm looking for. And if you ask their list, so they'll say something like, I'm looking for someone with a sense of humor, someone who's fun. I'm looking for someone who makes a good living so that he's responsible. I want someone who's going to be emotionally supportive. I want somebody who, you know, and the list goes on like this, which if you translate it into real terms, what it says is, me, 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 me. I want someone who's going to give me and take care of me, entertain me, and give me that, and take care of me, and me, 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 me. You know what the worst thing that could happen to you is? You find this person. That is the worst nightmare you could ever imagine. You know? Because assuming that you find someone who's really going to be there for you and really take care of you and not need you at all, and just give to you, you already have someone like that. It's called mom. And yet, it's an absolute truth, and everybody knows it. You know? And I've asked it to audiences all around the world. Who tends to love who more? Do parents love children more, or do children love parents more?
Parents.
Everybody knows it. Parents love children more, and it is so illogical. Right? Because if you think about it, as a person, right? You are born. You are not that multi-talented. You are not that attractive. You cry, you wet, you eat, you cry, you are bored, you cry, you're thinking your prayer, and your parents are taking care of you, changing your diapers, feeding you, caring for you, until you reach a point where you can start crawling around now. You know, they keep setting up gates, they lock up all their cabinets and put, you know, safety things in their whole house, and they're always locking everything up. That's how they're living. Until you get big enough that you can start walking. Now you slowly begin destroying their home. Start writing on the walls, and you feel like you're in a tenement, you know. And then they start throwing down things and breaking stuff that you had since you were a little child. Sentimental things. They're breaking them, smashing them, carrying on. And that someone who hates you will buy you a child Lego. Children don't like to play with Lego. There's two things they do with Lego. One is they like to take the whole thing, dump it over, and leave. And you're always threatening, I'm going to throw that Lego set out. But of course you're not, because it's worth too much money. So you are picking it up. The other thing is they pull out the Lego encyclopedia and go to their father and say, make me this. And the father gets down on the floor and he starts making the Lego horse and the kid leaves. But the father wants to finish because he's a guy and it's a challenge. And you know, all the dinner guests come and they're all sitting on the table and you're on the floor looking for the little red piece that they're looking for. You know? And then the kid goes to school, and suddenly parents are doing homework again, which they haven't had to do for years, you know? And it's always, the kid always remembers the report, like 5 minutes before bedtime, you know? Like, I have a report tomorrow, you know? You have to go to sleep, you know what I mean? And it doesn't really matter, because when you're in elementary school, it doesn't matter what the report is, it's only the cover, you know what I mean? So parents are making covers, and more elaborate covers, and fancier covers, and 3D covers, and the kid is sleeping, you know what I mean? And then comes the science fair, and you're making a little volcano that, you know, is making that, and, you know, you're making a little model of the eye, and the kid's watching, and it's vastly fascinated, you know what I mean? They only make science fair for the parents, you know? You've been going, and the kid's getting older and older, you know? And then they start getting every disease you can possibly imagine. It's always just before you're about to go away. You know what I mean? And sometimes you can just see, like, the pacifier melting in their mouth. You know what I mean? And you stay up with them, and they're sick, and they want to sleep in your bed, and then they throw up, and they have to change all of your litter in the middle of the night. And it goes on and on like this until the kid is a teenager. And now you should kill yourself. And now, finally, your child is an adult and you can have a real relationship with them. And you say, sweetheart, I want to have a relationship with you. And they say, leave me alone. You stay with me my whole life. You haven't did anything for me. I can't take it. I hate it. time they're like this. Feeling, I don't even know what happened. I don't know. Give me the car keys. Why? Because I want to be independent. Give me money. It costs money to be independent. When are you coming home? I wouldn't tell you if I knew. I want to go and do some risk-taking, irresponsible thing with your car. So when you think about it, it's totally illogical because, you know, we as kids, you know, we owe so much to our parents and everything they did for us, and all we have is this litany of complaints. And the reason, of course, because every kid knows that they can always play that line, I never asked to be born! I have a friend, he has a 44 Magnum, first kid who says that, no problem, I'll fix it right now. I didn't realize I made a mistake here. And the kid will say, let me rephrase that. What I meant is that I'm at a disadvantage in this relationship because you chose it and I didn't. And therefore, you are in a position to be able to give and you're able to do, and I really can't. That's why you see sometimes people who have bad relationships with their parents, once their parents start to get older and more frail, and the relationship starts to change, so that the whole nature of the relationship changes. Because we want to be able to be in a position to give, more than to give. We want to feel like it makes a difference what we do, that we feel obligated, that we're needed. Nobody wants to go in, and that's why nobody ever makes a list of what I can give to a relationship. We just make a list of what I can get from the relationship. But deep down, we want to give. And if we don't get to give that, we feel terrible. So we want to feel obligated. Not just we could. We have to. You're counting on me. This fellow was living in the New York area. He was working in Manhattan. He said to me, my wife is so unreasonable. I said, what do you mean? He says, I get up early in the morning. I have a terrible commute into Manhattan. I work very long hours because you have to put in extra time. I'm building my career. I come home late at night. All I want to do is, you know, take something to eat, take a shower, and go to sleep. And my wife, who's just totally inconsiderate, wants to talk to me. So could you believe it? You know? Yeah. She says, what do I do? I said, well, you stick to your guns. And eventually, she won't want to talk to you either. Now, the guy knew there was something wrong with this, but he couldn't quite figure out why, you know, because it sounds just like what he wants, right? And many times I've seen marriages fail, not because of real serious issues, just for lack of interest. You know, people don't work at it hard enough. You know, a few years ago, my schedule was I left the house at 6:30 in the morning. I came home at 10:45 at night. I was going nonstop from thing to thing to thing to thing. You know, I came home. I didn't want to eat supper, take a shower. I wanted to fall onto the bed in a fetal position and whimper myself to sleep, which would have taken me about 12 seconds. My wife, of course, has been home with all of my dysfunctional children, you know, waiting for someone to talk to who's on her side. She's been holding back the forces by herself, you know what I mean? And like, you know, and so I push myself and I force myself. I'll take a cup of coffee. Just like that. And I'll say, okay, I'm here for you, and I'll stay up and I'll fight to stay awake because I know all it takes, you know, relationships are like flowers. They need sunshine and rain in order to grow. Otherwise, they just wither. And all it takes is a lack of interest. So a guy says to me, I have a great relationship with God. I don't talk to him, he doesn't talk to me. I said, that doesn't sound like a great relationship. That sounds like a dysfunctional relationship. If I say I have a great relationship with my husband, I don't talk to him, he doesn't talk to me, nobody's going to say, wow, what a great relationship. That's the whole point. What did we talk about last time? We said, the whole reason we're in this world is to get this unbelievable spiritual pleasure that comes from being close to God. Fill in close to God and call it a relationship. To have a relationship with God. And to have a relationship with God, you have to have mitzvos. Because if you don't have any mitzvos, if they're not commandments, if God says they're suggestions, you feel like talking to me, talk to me. You don't want to talk to me, don't talk to me. You know, you want to eat a matzah, eat a matzah. Don't want to eat a matzah, don't eat a matzah. I don't really care what you do. Then there's no relationship. non-Jews who have a lower level relationship with God, they can always upgrade, become Jew if they want, they have that option. But if you want to have a lower relationship, you don't want to, you know, be close friends, that's fine. But they still have seven commandments, not suggestions. Anytime you're going to have a relationship has to come with commandments, with mitzvos, with obligations. And therefore, when I say I expect from you, that's only because I take you seriously. Because I want this relationship to be real. I don't want you to feel like, if you feel like it's fine, if not, not, and I'm not expected to participate. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us mitzvos, commandments, because it's something that we're supposed to do. And the numbers are pretty obvious. 365 negative commandments, 248 positive commandments. 365 is an easy number, that's days of the year. 248, right? So Avram, and you add the hay, becomes Avraham, equals 248. How many words in the three paragraphs of Shema? 245. It's a trick question. That's why we repeat the last three words. So you get it up to 248. 248 is seen as being the major parts of the body, the bones, and all that kind of stuff, right? So it's very interesting. When I'll be speaking to a group of young Jews, and I'll say, how do you define Judaism? What is Judaism? So people will say, it's a history, it's a culture, it's a people, it's a nation, it's a religion. You know, some people remember the SAT preparations. Ism is belief in, the belief in Judy. I asked someone, Judy who? I don't know, but it must have been, there must have been some Judy. You know? And then there's always someone who says, it's a way of life. Judaism is a way of life. I said, really? A way of life? Something that you do every day, 365 days a year, with every part of your body? And they say, no, 3 days a year. I said, you know, 3 days a year can't be a way of life. You know, you can't say, oh, I'm a strict vegetarian 3 days a year. I believe in exercise 3 days a year, whether I need it or not. Every 4 months, I get on the treadmill. You know what I mean? That you can do that, but you can't say that's a way of life. A way of life means that this has to be something that is a total system. And therefore, we have mitzvahs that affect every part of our body because it is supposed to be a total relationship. It's every single day. It's so sad when you have people say, you know, they say to me, what if, I hear people observing Jews, what if you had a day off? What if God said, I'm giving you one day off? It won't count. It won't count. It won't affect your soul. It won't be remembered up in the world to come. You have one day off. You have 24 hours to do whatever you want. It's amazing how many times I offer this to yeshiva students and you see the wheels spinning. And you see what they're thinking of. It's embarrassing. You know what I mean? I would do something, you know. Anyway, so occasionally it occurs to someone to turn to me and say, well, Rabbi, what would you do? I said, just what I'm doing now. I'm not doing this because I have to. I'm doing this because I enjoy being close to God. The mitzvahs are what builds this relationship. We talk about having this unbelievable, tremendous spiritual pleasure, but you got to do something. A person who says, I have a very, very close relationship, I never talk to the person, I never see the person, I have nothing to do with the person, I don't feel any obligation to the person, it's not a close relationship. It's a non-relationship. A real relationship means that I got to do stuff. Whatever the stuff is that I do, I have to do it. But they build the relationship. And granted, people sometimes don't focus on it, and then they miss the whole thing. We have these people who, like, they're doing God a favor. Okay, God, I daven melecha, leave me alone, no lightning bolts, you know what I mean? No car crashes, all right? That's it, leave me alone, Domayer, all right? I did what I have to do, and that's it, I'm done. You know, that's a kind of sad approach. You know, I did it, I'm done. You know, and I tell people, I said, what if my wife would say to me, listen, I know you're very busy and you have a lot of obligations. Tomorrow you're not married to me. You're off. Go do whatever you want. I said, why? What did I do? No. It's too much of a pressure for you. You'll be married 364 days a year. One day you'll be off, but I like you. No. No, everybody needs some time for themselves, you know what I mean? Not really, I just have nothing to do, so I'd much rather come home. Can I come home? No, you need your own time, You know, but it's only because of you're looking at it from the wrong point of view. We look at it from, not that we're building a relationship, but look at it as if it's an obligation, and something we have to do, and then people don't mitzvahs that way. So, in every relationship, there's mitzvahs in a marriage, right? There's a mitzvah. Thou shalt remember thy wife's birthday upon pain of death. You have to know this one. So, it's your wife's birthday, and you show up with a dozen long-stemmed roses. And she says, oh, for me? And you say, I have to, right? It's your birthday. Oh, I remember I forgot last year. I didn't hear the end of it for a month. Can you put it in water? You know what? I'll do the mitzvah mahadrin. I'll put it in water. All right, can I go now, or do I have to talk to you also? Because I really want to check my emails. Wasn't that beautiful? He did the mitzvah. That doesn't do anything. Wait a minute, nobody needs roses. And then you can't eat them. There's nothing you can do with them. Guys don't always get this, you know what I mean? Because guys will, like, on their wife's birthday, buy them a blender. You know what I mean? It's like, well, it's practical and you can use it, you know? Girls don't want those kind of things. Girls want worthless stuff that guys would never use. There are whole stores in every mall dedicated to worthless stuff that girls want, which no guy would ever want. If you have a guy friend, you don't say, hey, picked you up a glass figurine. The unicorn. I thought of you. Hey, thanks. I'll put it on my knick-knack shelf. No, I'm not going to go. Because it's not the gift. It's the feeling behind it. It's the emotion behind it. So Kurt Baruch needs you to eat a matzah? He gets a thrill out of that? He loves the crunch? Gathers together all the angels? Look at that! Crunch, crunch. Look, there's another one over there! Crunch, crunch. I love this time of year. Look, there's another one. Crunch, crunch. Oh, I wish Pesach would go on forever, you know? Where do they wave that palm thing? I love that part too, you know what I mean? God needs you to do a mitzvah? God's fine. When we do a mitzvah, the purpose of it is that we're building this relationship. Ideally, we should look into every mitzvah and understand how it builds the relationship. Sometimes we get so caught up with the process, we don't even stop to think. But how it builds the relationship is another explanation. Did we speak about matzah last time? All right, I'm gonna do this again. That's why I come back in March. But that's before Pesach. Matzah. I live in Israel. There's a whole different approach to matzah. Everybody wants to make their own matzahs, you know? And I would not eat any matzah that I participated in the baking of. I was once in a chabura, you know? It was a very, very religious chabura. They used, you know, they have these long sticks, and usually they put two or three or four matzahs on to put in. We put one matzah on a stick. And we used one stick one time. And my job was to reload the sticks. So I had the busiest job. I had this little thing you had to click them into. And they keep throwing me these things. Click, 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 click. Faster, faster. Click, 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 click. And the amazing thing is about this little device is this little fleshy part of your hand fits perfectly in. So, you know, I never knew where this came from, this idea of using the blood of a Christian child. I don't know about that, but there was definitely the blood of a middle-aged Jew, I can tell you that much, you know? Click, you know? Everybody bakes their own matzahs, they have their matzahs, they wrap it up, and they're very, people are very serious, they don't get their matzahs from here, you know? Then they sit down at the Seder, and they pull up these color-coded charts, and they have to measure the matzah, make sure they get just the right amount. And then, they have to eat in a certain amount of time, it doesn't start until you swallow. So they're shoving matzah in their mouth, and chewing it all up, and then, you know, someone makes you laugh, and you spit the crumbs out. You gotta start the whole thing over again, and you're getting all the matcha in, you know, and you're cleansing the whole matcha. And as this is all going on, I ask the following question: why do we eat matcha? And without hesitation, they all said, because the Jews came out of Egypt so quickly, their bread didn't have a chance to leaven. I said, so let it leaven now. for those of you who may be unfamiliar with this process of leavening, right? When you make challah dough and it doesn't rise in 18 minutes, you know what you do? Just wait. The Jews ran out of Egypt so quickly their bread didn't have a chance to leaven. So let it leaven now. So someone said to me, it's baked on their backs. I said, first of all, it says they baked it when they got there. Second of all, you know how hot it would have had to be to bake on their backs? What a fry these people. You know what I mean? No, man, now how do I mean? Anyway, so don't forget about that, right? They eat the Korban Pesach in their homes with their belts on, their shoes on, their walking sticks in their hands, because we're going to be rushing out of Egypt. At midnight, every firstborn gets killed. A cry goes up in Egypt. The Egyptians start pounding on the Jews' doors. Get out, get out, get out. They said, sorry, can't come out till the morning. God said so. And for 6 hours, they're pounding on their doors. Get out of Egypt, get out, get out. Finally comes the morning, they come out. Get out! Not dressed like this, what do you got? Yeah, they start going to the closet, collecting clothes, and like, this is that, that. Okay, okay, take the whole closet, just go. See, I'm getting jewelry. I mean, yeah, 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 take the jewelry, take the gold, take the silver. Okay, just get out, get out. All right, we got to load up the wagons and everything, you know. Okay, so go. I can't. Why? We have to cut down those trees. Why? Well, we're going to make a tabernacle. We need those trees. Jacob Pedler. They're cutting down trees. All right, we got your trees, go. Wait, we need instruments. Why? Because we have to play them at the Red Sea. Why? You'll find out. Weapons to fight a Moloch later in the desert. We need weapons. Okay, can you go now? Nope, we have to wait for Moshe. Why? He's looking for Joseph's bones. Anyone seen Joseph's bones? No, Joseph's bones. This is going on for another 6 hours. Finally, they get Joseph's bones. They get the trees. They get the gold and the silver. They're all packed up for 12 hours. The Egyptians have been screaming at them to go. And suddenly, the Jewish people has won the side. What a great time to bake bread. Somebody say to her just to cause trouble. And apparently they stop for a second. And they look at me and say, okay, why do you eat matzah? I said, what are you asking me for? You know, you go and bake it in a special bakery and you're measuring and you're eating. Don't you even know why you're doing this? No. Alright. But you have to have a reason for it. You have to know what you're doing it for. So every single mitzvah builds this relationship with God. But if you look deeper into it, you'll find out how. You'll find out what the meaning behind it is. Stephen Covey, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. So he writes that for reasons that were not clear to him, you know, his wife only wanted, see if I remember correctly, I think it was a GE refrigerator or something like that, or a GE oven. She only wanted to buy GE. And sometimes it was more expensive than that, but I always wanted to buy this, and he didn't know why, but it was very important to her. And it took her years to finally tell her why. When her father, during the Depression, didn't have a job, you know, and couldn't make it, GE used to give him, you know, consignments to do and things to do, and he told his kids, you know, you owe a debt of gratitude to GE, and she always had this with her. So the husband didn't know why it was so important, but he knew it was important. So sometimes we may not know why these things are so important to God, but the more you understand it, the richer it becomes, the more understanding it becomes, the more you begin to appreciate what these things are. That ultimately becomes the purpose of mitzvahs. Now, there's one other aspect of it that I really have to develop that I think is important, and that's the following. 650 commandments are a lot of commandments. It's good. They don't all apply, but there's still plenty. Plenty to keep us busy. Yeah? Whenever you have a lot of things to do, you can get so caught up with the process, you get so caught up with the road, you don't realize what you're doing. So, you want to play piano? You want to play piano? So everybody knows. You're going to have to do do re mi fa sol la ti do, do re mi fa sol la ti do. You're going to have to learn the scale, learn the chords, learn the keys. You're going to have to practice using your hands, knowing what to push, knowing what to do. That comes first. If you build past the point of bum ba da da 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 bum. There was a piano in the library. And there was always a kid going, bum ba da da bum ba da da bum. And he didn't even do the second part. You had to hope someone come by and go, bum, 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 bum. And they passed a law in New York State that if somebody plays that for more than 15 minutes and you'll kill them, you're not responsible. Because you've been pushed beyond all reasonable levels, right? Let's say you move beyond that and you keep practicing, right? My friend Evie Rottenberg, who's well known from Jewish music, when he lived in Los Angeles, I would sometimes go over to his house, and he would first sit down at the piano and start to play. I didn't recognize any of the tunes. I said to his wife, "What's he playing?" He says, "He's playing his day." He could just sit down and turn his feelings into music. But he had to learn how to play the piano, just like everybody else. So my kids wanted to learn how to play the piano, and I was sure it was just another passing phase. And there was always a chance that I was going to buy them one of these fancy, you know, keyboards, you know. I bought them the cheapest one. And one by one, the keys started to break off. So they don't even bother talking to me. They go right to the mother. They know already. And my wife says, "Listen, you know, the keys are breaking off." I said, "So use the ones that are left, you know." "This one's good. What's wrong with this one, you know?" And she says, "No, you can't play music that way." "Why? What's wrong?" "Da-da-da-dum, da-da-da-da, you know, what's the big deal, you know?" "It's more or less, as well, if you want to play the piano, you need all of the keys. And you need all of the keys all the time, you know, and they have to all be in tune, right?" A person wants to go and work out in the gym to achieve, you know, total body, you know, fitness. So you can't just exercise your legs or exercise your arms or exercise your abs, even though no one even knows what those are. And they've only discovered in the past 10 years when I went to school, they didn't have any abs. And well, for that matter, did they have self-esteem? We didn't even know what it was, you know. If you used to say to you, "Stop that, stupid," and you did. We didn't know. We didn't know they were destroying our self-esteem. I wish I knew, because I would have said, "You're destroying my self-esteem." And then they would have said, "Oh, okay, then just keep doing what you're doing, and that would be fine." But, you know, you keep exercising. So when Robin Williams played Popeye, he did these exercises just to blow up his forearms. You know, you look kind of weird, you know what I mean? But you understand, if you have to exercise, you'll never achieve, right? So there was a movie many, many years ago called The Karate Kid. Most kids, I was just at a school, I mentioned it, and they've all still seen it, I guess, in DVDs and reruns and whatever it is, cable, I don't know. But those of you who remember the movie, you know, basically this kid wants to learn karate, and the old man tells him, "Paint the fence, paint the fence, paint the fence, paint the fence." And he comes back the next day, and there's all this deck, sand the deck, sand all the deck. And he comes back the next day, he says, "Wax the cars, wax on, wax off," you know, he does all this stuff. And at the end of 3 days, the kid says to the old man, "You know, you make me a slave, you make me do all this stuff." He says, "Show me wax on. Show me paint the fence." "I know what you mean." And he starts to attack him, and instinctively, he has all these moves because he's been practicing them for so long. So I have a friend who's a black belt in karate, New York City police officer, an Orthodox Jew, an average sort of guy. And I said to him, "Was there anything to that movie?" He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "You know this movie here with this?" He says, "No, that's nothing. But there is one part that's very true. You know that old paint the fence, wax on, wax off?" He says, "That's most of karate. People figure you put on your pajamas and you go, yeah! That's a good way to get yourself killed. You know what I mean? You jump and go, black belt. And the other guy goes, monkey wrench. You know what I mean? And that's it. You know, you're gone, you know?" He says, "You got to practice, practice, practice the same things over and over again." And then he says to me, it's a lot like Judaism. I said, "Really? You know?" He says, "Sure." He says, "What do you think? You're just going to start doing a mitzvah one time and it's going to have meaning to you?" Right? A person davens, they open up a siddur, and they think that suddenly the clouds are going to part, and a ray of light is going to shine on them, and the angels will sing, "No!" And I'll start to pray, and I'll present it. Baruch she'omar v'haya ha'olam. Baruch ho. And that's just not going to be that deep and spiritual and meaningful. You have to learn how to make it work. You have to learn the prayers and learn what they mean and make them meaningful for you if you want it to become meaningful. My children take ballet. I have 8 girls. Thank you. It's one of the reasons I travel. So only during these trips that I get the bathroom to myself. It's so amazing. No one's pounding on the doors. It's great, you know. And I'm one of six boys. There were no girls in my family, which just shows you that God has a sense of humor. So one of the joys I did not have when I was growing up was ballet lessons. None of my brothers wanted to take ballet. But all of my daughters take ballet. And I'm paying a lot of money for this, so I want to see something really impressive. You'll forgive me here.
So they come home one day, I say, what did you learn? They said this. So those of you who can see, I just put my feet at right angles. It's called third position. I said, I'm not impressed. Soon they learned how to put their arm over their head. Soon they could bend their knees. Soon they could do all three of them together. And I said to my wife that that's not dance. And she says, no, it's not. But first you have to learn the moves.
First you have to learn the moves, and then you have to put them all together. When you know the notes to sing, you can sing most anything. But first you need to do re mi fa sol la ti do, right? Until you have the notes, you can't use it. Until you have the steps, you can't dance. And the other moves, you can't do karate. You have to learn all the moves. The problem with mitzvahs are that we do it piecemeal. They're all united. Everything comes together. It's all one. The purpose of all these mitzvahs is that it affects me completely. It means that I make my entire life a symphony. I make my entire life a dance. I make my entire life, you know, a work of art. I was once passing by these two yeshiva guys who were staring at a painting about this far away. I don't know, I was walking by and I said, it's a story, let's listen in. Always looking for material. And one guy said to the other, you see, Chaim, if you look really close, they're just little lines. That's right. People who are really, really bored, and they just keep enlarging those photographs on the computer until they turn them just dots. Because you just have too much time on your hands, you know what I mean? So that's what they are, they're just dots. But if you put them all together, you get a picture. They're just little waves, just little, you know, brush strokes. But you put them all together, you get yourself a painting. You get yourself a work of art. A person does a mitzvah here and a mitzvah there. A person doesn't understand that the ultimate goal is to be able to build something that's a total system. Mitzvahs are there to be able to create for us a total being, 248 parts of our body, 365 days a year, that we can put our entire life together. Let's face it, this is one of the hardest parts. The hardest part is having a relationship with an infinite being when we're finite. And the only way to be able to do that, to really get it, is by approaching from this point of view, or from that point of view. Rabbi Lev gives an example. He says, you know, if you imagine a big globe around a beautiful work of art with 613 holes in it, and you look in this hole, and you look in that hole, and every hole you look in, you're seeing it from a different perspective. If you can get all of those holes together, and you see the whole total picture, then you can really appreciate it. This is the problem. People look at mitzvahs as I have to's and commandments, but the truth of the matter is if you want to build a relationship comes with I have to's. It comes with rules and regulations. It comes with meaning. And just like every step in a ballet and every note in a symphony by itself may not seem that important to us, when we put them all together, we have a total system. And everything fits together. I have the source of going twice a week to Rav Moshe Shapiro to hear Torah classes. And sometimes he does this in England. He used to do it on a Motzi Shabbos. He'd invite his Talmudim. And everyone could ask a question. This one's asking a question in Rashi. This one's asking a Tosis in Gemara. This one's asking a question in Kabbalah. This one's asking a question in Halacha. And after everybody asks their questions, he gives one shir on the parasha. And that one shir answers all the questions. Because everything ties together. It's not piecemeal. All those notes fit together in a symphony. All those brush strokes make a work of art. It's the difference between living a life that's a work of art or a life that's made up of little pieces. So we asked the question last time, why should a person, you know, live a Jewish lifestyle? And the answer is because you get this infinite pleasure from being close to God. How do you do it? That's what the mitzvahs are for. Because if they're weren't these mitzvahs, if God didn't give us these mitzvahs, then he doesn't care about this relationship. And if it had obligations, then that would build the relationship, because it means that God cares about us. And that means that we're invested in it. And the more invested we are, and the more we work on it, we change aspects of ourselves. People don't even realize it. Just like every exercise develops a muscle, every mitzvah develops another part of your spiritual being, until you reach yourself up, that you look at life differently. And everything in this world becomes something that's pleasurable, because it becomes this unbelievable, infinite spiritual pleasure. What we eat, where we go, what we wear, you know, everything that we do is suddenly filled with this unbelievable spiritual pleasure, because we bring God into every aspect and we change our whole life. That's a reason to do mitzvahs. That's a way that we use it to get this unbelievable pleasure. And if people do it, like I say, it takes practice. If people do it, it means that their entire life changes around to the point where the person says, what if you had it off? I'd do it anyway. Because it brings you so much happiness and so much fulfillment. If I had more time, I would give an example of one mitzvah. I guess when I come back again, I'll give an example of a mitzvah, how we can do that. How we can use that as an opportunity to be able to see how any one mitzvah can do this for us. For now, I'll just have to leave you and say that we see that there's something beautiful here within the mitzvahs. If we look into each one and use it, then we can help to make ourselves a life that's a work of art, and be able to use this for ourselves to get this unbelievable pleasure. Thank you very much.